Chapter 30. Gun Deaths. When you consider that firearms were invented in the 14th century, it seems strange that it's taken so long for the gun to achieve its present preeminence as a murder weapon. The pistol, probably invented around 1450 in Pistoia in Italy, is certainly one of the quickest and most efficient methods of taking life, its chief disadvantages being that it's noisier than a knife and a great deal less discreet than poison. This undoubtedly explains why the entry of the firearm into criminal history was relatively late and unspectacular. The Middlesex County records for the year 1602 contain the following entry. On the highway at Hounslow, County Middlesex, Francis Kimber, a gentleman of London, assaulted William Peveril with a certain instrument called a pistol, which he, the said Francis, with his right hand, pointed at the said William's breast and put him in great fear and terror. No further information is given, but it's clear that the writer is not at all familiar with the properties of pistols. Pistols certainly came as a boon to highwaymen, who prior to the 16th century used swords and knives as their main weapons of intimidation. James Shaw, a highwayman who was armed only with a sword, robbed several coaches and single passengers, and that with very great inhumanity, which was natural, he said, from his method of attacking. Shaw got the victim to hand over his wallet by holding a sword to his throat, solving the problem of pursuit by hamstringing the victim's horse or slashing the muscles at the back of his victim's knees. By 1720, the year in which Shaw was executed, England had been engulfed by a crime wave. The pistol had revolutionised the art of robbery. In one three-week period, there were 25 major highway robberies around London, and people in coaches and sedan chairs were robbed in broad daylight in crowded streets. The law tried to halt the epidemic with sheer barbarity. The gallows at Tyburn were in use from morning till night, and even women and children were executed for stealing a few pence. When someone asked a notoriously strict judge, Sir Francis Page, after his health, the old man quavered jocularly, "Oh, I keep hanging on, hanging on." But it made no difference. The crime wave continued until it was finally halted by the creation of an efficient police force more than half a century later. Yet in spite of the highway robbers, surprisingly few murders were committed with guns. Most people preferred to stick to the old methods, knives, hatchets and bludgeons. Dick Turpin, the famous highwayman, committed a murder, his only one, with a pistol. But that was of a man trying to arrest him. And 10 years later, a party of smugglers added a curious episode to the history of firearms in one of the most gruesome murder cases. A customs officer named Galley, travelling in company with a shoemaker named Chater, made the mistake of stopping for a drink in the Hampshire village of Rowland's Castle. As soon as the word got around that there was a customs officer at the inn, the local smugglers moved in. Galley was tortured with a pair of spurs, his testicles were squeezed until he fainted, and then he was whipped to death. Chater was also tortured, but no one was willing to take on the responsibility of killing him. Finally, someone suggested that they should put a loaded gun to his head, tie a long string to the trigger, and that all 14 of the smugglers should then pull the trigger. If they had gone through with it, it would have raised an interesting point of law, whether 14 men can all be convicted for the same murder. But they decided against it. Instead, they threw Chater down a well, alive, and buried him with stones. By that time, half the smugglers had got tired of the whole thing and gone home, so only 7 were eventually tried and executed for the murders. The mistrust of firearms persisted even into the 19th century. The two most widely publicised crimes of the 1820s were William Corder's murder of Maria Martin in the Red Barn and the murder of William Weir by Thurtle and Hunt. Corder shot his ex-mistress Maria Martin with a pistol, and although, as he confessed, she fell and died in an instant, he then stabbed her several times with a carving knife. When Thurtle and Hunt, two sporting gentlemen, murdered the crooked bookmaker William Weir in 1823, they began by discharging a pistol in his face. The bullet glanced off Weir's cheekbone, and the wounded man ran away. Thurtle flung him to the ground and cut his throat with a penknife, then jammed the pistol against his head with such force that it smashed the skull, filling the barrel with blood and brains. When Thurtle was executed in 1824... Hunt escaped with a sentence of transportation. Street hawkers were selling a poem that doesn't mention the pistol. "They cut his throat from ear to ear, his head they battered in. His name was Mr. William Weir. He lived in Lion's Inn." If criminals were unhappy about the use of firearms, the police disliked them even more. If a man was killed with a knife or a bludgeon, the murder weapon could be produced in court and the jury convinced that it had inflicted the wounds. But a gun was a different matter. The bullet might have been knocked out of shape against a bone, and in any case it was almost impossible to prove which gun had fired it. Fortunately, there were a few men who took a less defeatist attitude. One of these was Dr. Joseph Bell, the man who inspired Conan Doyle with the idea of Sherlock Holmes. On August the 10th, 1893, an ex-army tutor named A.J. Monson went out shooting with his employer's son, a youth called Cecil Hambrough. As Cecil was climbing over a dike, there was a shot, and he fell dead. Monson claimed that the boy's gun had exploded accidentally, but when it was discovered that Monson had insured Hambrough's life, he was arrested and charged with murder. The key factor was whether Hambrough really had accidentally shot himself at close range, or whether Monson had shot him from a few feet away. According to Monson, Cecil had been carrying the gun over his shoulder and had stumbled and blown off the back of his head. Dr. Bell brooded on the question. Shotguns are notoriously unpredictable weapons. Finally, Bell took a 12-bore shotgun to the morgue in Edinburgh and fired it into the skull of a corpse. What he observed enabled him to say confidently in court that Cecil Hambrough could not have been shot with his own gun. He was shot from a distance of between 6 and 9 feet from behind. Bell's evidence should have hanged Monson, but the defence managed to confuse the issue with such a mass of financial evidence that Monson was acquitted on a Scottish verdict of not proven. Nevertheless, Dr. Bell had proved that where guns were concerned, no pathologist needs to acknowledge defeat. At the time Dr. Bell was firing shotguns into cadavers in Edinburgh, another firearms expert ran a gun shop near Charing Cross Station. His name was Ted Churchill. His shop was conveniently close to Scotland Yard, and he was often summoned there to give his opinion in cases involving guns. When Ted Churchill wanted to find out how far the bullets from a certain gun would damage a human skull, he tested the gun by firing at a sheep's head. And it was Ted Churchill's evidence that hammered the last nail into the coffin of a swindler and murderer called Samuel Herbert Dougal. Dougal was what the sensational press would now call a sex maniac. His libidinous appetite was truly extraordinary. On one occasion he had seduced a mother and her three daughters. His career in the army had been reasonably successful, although two wives had died under somewhat suspicious circumstances. After his discharge, however, Dougal found it difficult to continue to live in the manner he preferred. Seduction cost money. He tried his hand at forgery, was caught, and served a prison sentence. Then he had the good fortune to meet a middle-aged spinster named Camille Holland, who soon allowed herself to be seduced. Miss Holland was rich. In 1899, Dougal and Mrs. Dougal moved into rooms in Saffron Walden, while Dougal carried out negotiations to buy a property called Moat Farm near Clavering with Miss Holland's money. The landlady took a great liking to the sweet gentleman-mannered Mrs. Dougal. Then her lodgers moved into Moat Farm, and she saw no more of the lady. At Moat Farm, Dougal was now living alone, although he had a succession of young female visitors. 4 years went by. And then, in March of 1903, a police officer called to question Dougal about the missing Camille Holland. Dougal explained that he had never married Miss Holland because he was in the process of divorcing his previous wife. Miss Holland, he said, had left him for another man in 1899, not long after moving into Moat Farm. The police found the story unlikely. They knew that Dougal had made determined attempts to seduce a servant girl shortly after moving into the farm, and there had been quarrels between husband and wife. The police began digging in the garden, and they continued digging in spite of Dougal's threats to sue the chief constable for damaging his crops. The moats that gave the farm its name were drained, but no body was found in the black mud. Then the police heard about a ditch that had been filled in on Dougal's instructions. They found the man who had superintended the work, and they dug where he suggested. Soon the police were looking down at the badly decomposed body of Miss Holland. The pathologist's report showed that she had died from a gunshot wound in the side of the head. A bootmaker identified the boots on the corpse as having been made for Miss Holland. Now it was up to Ted Churchill. No revolver had been found, but there were a number of .32 caliber bullets found at the farm. Churchill fired some of these bullets into a sheep's head. In court, he was able to demonstrate not only that the bullet found in Miss Holland's skull was a somewhat distorted .32, but that it must have been fired by someone sitting beside her, probably in a car. He had been able to produce a crack in the sheep's skull practically identical with that in the head of Camille Holland. Throughout the trial, Dougal had been cheerful and ironically polite, but as Churchill gave his evidence, his sang-froid disappeared. He recognised that this was the end, and indeed it was. He was executed on July the 8th, 1903. As the trap was about to open, the chaplain whispered urgently, "Guilty or not guilty?" And from under the hood that covered Dougal's head came a muffled reply, "Guilty." The man who, more than any other, was responsible for turning ballistics into a science was not Ted Churchill, but his nephew, Robert Churchill, who took over the family gun shop in 1910. The affair that first brought him to public notice was the case of the Hooded Man. In the early hours of October the 9th, 1912, Inspector Arthur Walls of Eastbourne Police saw a burglar crouched on the portico of a house in Southcliffe Avenue, and he called to him to come down. Instead, the burglar fired two shots, and Walls fell dead. Not long afterwards, the police discovered the identity of the killer. He was George Mackay, alias John Williams, a petty crook. Mackay was betrayed by a friend, Edgar Powers, who was in love with the burglar's beautiful mistress, Florence Seymour. At the instigation of the police, Powers persuaded the girl to lead him to the revolver with which Walls had been killed. She had helped Mackay bury it on the beach. Churchill's task was to try to prove that the bullet that had killed Walls had been fired from this revolver. At that time, there was no sure way of proving that a particular bullet had been fired from a certain gun. More than 10 years were to pass before this became possible with the comparison microscope. But Churchill devised a way of showing the jury that the rifling on the bullet corresponded closely to the rifling inside the barrel of the gun. He poured wax into the gun and made a cast of the inside of the barrel. In court, he produced enlarged photographs of the bullet and of the wax cast. The jury could see how closely they corresponded. Mackay, known in the press as the Hooded Man, because the police kept him hooded on his journeys to court, they were still searching for witnesses to identify him, was convicted of the murder and hanged in January 1913. Before he died, he was allowed to kiss his newly born child. He placed a piece of prison bread in the baby's mouth, saying, "Now no one can say your father never gave you anything." It was in June 1914 that a young Bosnian called Gavrilo Princip fired the two shots that led to the outbreak of the First World War. Archduke Ferdinand of Austria was visiting Sarajevo with his duchess. Serbian patriots wanted to register their protest about the Austrian occupation of Bosnia. Shortly after 10 a.m. on June the 28th, 1914, a bomb was thrown at the Archduke's carriage, but it missed, wounding several spectators instead. An hour later, the Archduke left the town hall and remarked to his wife, "I've got a feeling there may be more bombs around." He was mistaken. The weapon that Gavrilo Princip concealed in his pocket was a Browning revolver with 6 shots in it. The car approached Princip, and then turned off into another street. Modern history hung in the balance. Then someone shouted that the car had taken the wrong turn. The route had been revised. It backed and proceeded past the young Bosnian, who drew his revolver and fired twice at close range. One shot killed the Archduke, and the other his wife. Princip was seized, but the decisive tragedy of modern history had taken place, and the rest followed inevitably. Austria's declaration of war on Serbia, Russian mobilisation, the Kaiser's declaration of war on Russia. Those two revolver shots also launched the world into a new epoch, the Age of Guns. The 1914 war was the first time that vast numbers of men actually handled guns. Before the war, most guns were owned by farmers or sportsmen. Now everybody learned how to use them. An early Spencer Tracy film called They Gave Him a Gun puts its finger on what happened. The servicemen came back from Europe and found a new world that had already forgotten the war and the men who fought in it. There were no jobs for the returning heroes. Life was hard. So many of them decided to make use of what they had learned in the army, and suddenly the police were faced with the greatest crime wave since 1720. But this time it was not just in England, but in America, France, Italy, Germany. The petty criminal, who had never stolen anything larger than a watch, discovered that it was just as easy to walk into a bank and point a gun at the cashier. And the Americans, with an innocence and optimism that now seems stunning, decided to reform their country by banning all alcoholic liquor, and thereby produced an entirely new breed of social parasite called the mobster. 70 years later, in spite of numerous acts of Congress and commissions of inquiry, America is still as securely in the mobster's hands as it was in Al Capone's. In most of the countries of the world, the authorities have achieved some sort of control by banning the sale of guns to private citizens. In America, financial interests, known as the gun lobby, continue to prevent a measure that would probably cut the crime rate by 75%. America's gun problem is not so much social as psychological. The past 50 years have seen an alarming increase in mass murders committed with guns, and the majority of such cases have taken place in America. On December the 30th, 1950, a young psychopath named William Cook stopped a car driven by Carl Moser. Moser's wife, three young children, and a family dog were also in the car. Cook brandished a gun and made the Moser family drive around Texas for 72 hours. Then, when the wife and children became hysterical, he killed them all. On September the 6th, 1949, a 28-year-old ex-GI named Howard Unruh walked out of his house in Camden, New Jersey, carrying a German Luger pistol, and in the next 12 minutes killed 13 people at random. Captured after a siege of his home, Unruh declared, "I'd have killed 1,000 if I'd had enough ammunition." In January 1958, Charles Starkweather took his girlfriend, Carol Fugate, on a murder rampage across Nebraska and had shot and killed 10 people, mostly strangers, before he was captured a couple of days later. In Lathrop Village, Michigan, in August 1968, a family of six called Robinson were all executed by an unknown killer with a .22 revolver. In October 1970, John Lindley Frazier executed the family of Dr. Victor Ota at his home near Santa Cruz, California, and threw the five bodies into the swimming pool. On November the 7th, 1973, a family of nine, four adults, three teenagers and two children, were all shot through the head by unknown killers at their home near Victor, California. It would be possible to list dozens, even hundreds, of such cases that have taken place in America. The only English parallel is the case of psychopath Peter Manuel, who killed two families with a gun in late 1956 and early 1957. But one more will suffice. On November the 15th, 1959, two ex-convicts named Perry Smith and Richard Hickok broke into the house of the Clutter family near Holcomb, Kansas, and slaughtered all four in the course of robbery. In 1966, Truman Capote's reconstruction of the crime, In Cold Blood, broke best-selling records in America, although it failed to achieve the same success in other countries. Obviously, Capote had touched on some strange, dark nerve in the American psyche. If we understood this, we should understand something important about the mysterious lure of gun violence in America. That lure can only be quashed by outlawing the gun.